was to come out, and they said, you can't have the room, it's reserved for Montgomery.
The House Education Committee will come to order, which is sometimes very difficult for some members of our committee. So today we're going to jump around on our agenda a little bit. We are having a couple of technical difficulties in terms of sound, but we're going to plow through anyway because I know Senator Cruz is able to be flexible and have people working on technology while you speak. So the way this is going to work today, we are first going to temporarily open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1509 so we can hear from Senator Cruz. Then Senator Cruz is going to leave, and we're going to close or temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1509. Then we're going to go to our informational meeting on boosting literacy. We'll hear first from the Down Syndrome Association and then from Decoding Dyslexia. And then right about 2 o'clock, we will come back to Senate Bill 1509, which is the mascots bill. We've got to be out of this room by about 2:45 or 2:50, and we will vote on this bill today. Any questions from anybody on the committee before we dive in? All right. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1509. Senator Cruz, and Richard, could you briefly describe?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1509 will allow school district boards to enter into an approved written agreement with a federally recognized Native American tribe in Oregon to determine appropriate use of a mascot that represents or is associated with that tribe for use as a mascot in the school.
Great. Welcome, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. Mr. Donovan is as familiar with this as anybody could be because he also chairs the Senate committee. This is round two, and this time we got it right. This bill passed the Senate on a 29-0 vote. The governor is on record as saying he will sign the bill if it gets to his desk unamended, and I hope that's what you're going to choose to do. We kind of went back to square one with this, and looking at issues that the executive branch had, and I think quite honestly it was a matter of asking the governor to override a decision of one of his boards through legislation. And so what we are doing in this bill, and I think we'll get to the place we all want to be, it's just going to take us a little longer to get there, is we're going to go back through the rule writing process again. But I think in this case, having a committee that has more appropriate membership on the committee to look at how the rule will be written. I have had conversations with Rob Saxon on this issue, and we will actually have representatives of Oregon's tribes on this committee. We will have people from school districts on this committee. These are the ones who are most affected. At the end of the day, our goal is to kind of honor a lot of discussions and agreements that have already been reached virtually everywhere in the state and not have unintended consequences. And I'm going to speak directly. I actually had a chance meeting this weekend with the chair of the Cow Creek tribe. We were both making dump runs at the same time, which was interesting. It's a nice place to have a high-level meeting, I guess. And I explained everything to him about what we're doing. He's absolutely fine with it. And what he brought up to me, one of the unintended consequences in our community, for example, because in Douglas County, the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua Indians is a great partner on virtually everything we do. And they have already worked out all of the issues as far as the Roseburg Indians and the symbols that are used, and everybody's fine with it. One of the unintended consequences that concerned the tribe greatly was that if this ruling by the state board went into effect, that the tribe would probably be seen in the community as being the cause of changing something that a lot of the community didn't want to be changed. So to a degree, there was a possibility through no action of the tribe or the community or the school, in and of themselves, we would have taken a relationship that has become, that has flourished for well over a decade, and taking it backwards. And that's something we clearly do not want to do. I want to thank the governor's office for their willingness to sit down and work through these things and come to a place of mutual agreement. And I won't, you know, when I talk to folks from school districts and stuff like that, they're somewhat confused by the language. But unfortunately, I have been in this building long enough to understand the language now. And sometimes the way we write things doesn't make sense to people who aren't here. But the reality of it is that this process is going to take a fair amount of time, because when you go through rule writing, you have to post, and you got to take comments, and all those things will happen. There is a commitment at this point in time that as the rules are written, there will be consultation with the tribes in the state of Oregon. And at the end of the day, I think we're going to get to a place that everybody can be happy and satisfied. And I would also point out, and this is a conversation Senator Roblin and I have had, I think one of the side benefits of this two-year process we've gone through is I think there's going to be a serious commitment to how we teach Oregon history in the state of Oregon. And both Senator Roblin and I are actually committed to making sure that actually we start really teaching Oregon history and all aspects of it, and including the values that our tribal members have had in this state and their history as well. It's all part of it, and I think it's time that our kids learn the true history of Oregon. And so it's going to take us a while to get there, but we're committed to working in that direction. So I hope that you will be agreeable to move this bill to the floor of the House, and then we'll be on our way to a solution. So thank you very much.
And Senator, can I just ask for a clarification of how this actually works in this bill? So what this bill says is that a school district and a tribe can enter into an agreement,
yes,
for the use of a mascot at a school district.
Right.
And once that agreement is reached, they then have to go to the State Board of Ed for approval, and the State Board of Ed will adopt rules about what the criteria are for that by 2017.
Actually, Madam Chair, that's kind of backwards. What will happen is the State Board will adopt the rules setting the parameters for the agreement, and then a tribe and a school district can reach their agreement in those parameters, and that's as far as they have to go with it.
And then in the development of the rules, the statute would require better communication with tribal governments in the process of developing those rules.
The tribal representation will be a key component of the committee that writes the rules.
Thank you. Any other questions for Senator Cruz? Representative Gorsuch?
Senator, what's the geography of this? Does the tribe have to have a geographic proximity to the school district?
I think that's going to be open to some interpretation, but I think for the most part those relationships have already been established, and so I don't think that there's going to be a whole lot of guessing as to who. I mean, there's 15 schools that are impacted by the ruling of the State Board, and I would suggest that in all 15 cases they have already established a relationship, so we aren't creating anything new from that perspective.
Follow up. And so we're talking about tribes that are currently federally recognized.
Yes, we are.
What about non-aligned Native Americans?
They will certainly have the ability to comment and be on the record, but you have to draw a line somewhere, and this is the line we have chosen to draw, because this is, you know, because we're talking number one about government to government relationships here, and those are the tribes that we have those sorts of relationships, both at the state and also at the county and city and school district level.
Thank you.
Representative Reardon?
Thank you. Senator, thank you for being here today. And I must confess, I'm really having a hard time with this bill. And I'm not sure why it's affecting me. So I've been working very hard to understand it. It looks like you've done tremendous things getting a lot of people behind the bill. But I still have some fundamental questions that I think I would like to ask you. First of all, and may I ask a couple of questions?
A couple of questions, and then recall that we're going to come back to this at 2.
But he won't come back.
He won't come back, okay. But we will have Representative Springer, who's the other sponsor.
Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, she told me after I was testified I had to leave. So
okay. You're always welcome with us, Senator Cruz.
How many tribes are there in the state, and how many would be represented at the meeting that would be held to set the parameters?
There are 9 federally recognized tribes in the state of Oregon. There are clearly other tribes, but like I said, we had to draw a line someplace, and the simplest way to do it was to look at those tribes to which we already have government-to-government relationships.
Okay. In any given community where this agreement might be established, would the federally recognized tribe represent all the Native Americans within that community?
I would suggest not. You know, in the same way that, you know, there's very few groups that are that inclusive, I wouldn't think. But in this process, there will be the opportunity for anybody, tribal or non-tribal, to opine as we're going through the rulemaking process.
Final follow-up?
I think I'll have the opportunity to ask the question further down the road, so I'll hold off for now. Thank you.
Any other questions for Senator Cruz before we leave him?
Madam Chair, if I could, just one more comment for Representative Reardon. It kind of depends on where you start as to how you look at this, as to whether this is a negative or positive. I've been a Roseburg Indian my whole life, and it's a sign of pride for me. There's nothing negative about that for me whatsoever in any of this. It's a sign of it's a mark of pride for me, and so it kind of, I suppose, to a degree, comes on where you start.
All right. Would you like to say one more thing then?
Sure.
Unfortunately, and this is the part I struggle with, is that there are a lot of Native Americans within this state that do not see it as a sense of pride. They are greatly offended by it. They are hurt by it. It affects them academically and in about every other way. And I can't figure out how to justify those two positions in my mind. They're both Native Americans. They're both members of this state, and I'm trying to represent all of them, and I just am really having a hard time with it. So if you,
I understand. So, Madam Chair, thank you very much for accommodating me.
Thank you. It's always good to have you. And you are, of course, welcome to come back. Should you see us on the TV and with us, please.
Okay.
Always feel welcome. Okay, so I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1509A. We will come back to it. And I'm going to open up a work session on an informational hearing on students, not on students. We did that last week. Boosting literacy. Okay, I'm opening an informational hearing on boosting literacy. And we're going to start with Joyce Rogers, Ron Schaaf, and Dev Evans from the Southern Oregon Down Syndrome Association. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Education Committee. We're honored to be here. My name is Deb Evans, and this is Joyce Rogers and Ron Schaaf. We're here today to talk to you about a reading program that the three of us have developed in Southern Oregon starting 10 years ago. We would like to begin by letting you know that we're not soundbite people, but we're going to do our best today to shorten our presentation to accommodate everybody to get done by 2 o'clock. The three of us before you are parents of tag kids.
We are to be clear. There's another presentation after you that also has to be done by 2 o'clock.
Right. I know. Okay, I know. Yes, I did remember that. Thank you. We're parents of TAG kids and individuals with special needs. We have served on public school boards, private advisory committees, site councils, and public school foundations. One of us has an East Coast private school education. Two of us have come from poverty in the state of Oregon. One of us has failed to achieve the gap years ago in Portland public schools. This diversity is our strength. We have passed out some information. We'll not get to everything that's in our packet, but we hope that you can look at the packet that is going to be passed out to you with more information. And now I would like to show you a 3-minute video, and then we'll go into behind how the Reading About Me program works. And it's not doing the sound still. He's got it up. So unfortunately, we have no sound. But I'm not sure why.
Reading About Me is the beginning reading program.
Oh, I hear something.
I hear something over
it's
here.
It's really low. Where's that sound coming from?
It's coming directly out of the computer, it sounds like.
It's not going through a system.
Reading About Me focuses on emphasizing the reading process.
Okay. Could we, what if we put it next to a computer and put the microphone next to a computer? Would that work? I can lend you my computer.
Reading About Me.
Is this all in OLIS?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, okay, here, I will bring you my computer. Let me.
Well, we could continue on and come back to it.
You can just put it in your microphone.
Oh, I can just put it in my microphone. Representative Springer is so brilliant, as always. All right, so where would I go to? Meeting materials?
Yeah.
Video link. Check it out. All right, so.
So what do I need to do?
So put yours on mute, and then when we say, on your mark, get set, go, we will both click at the same time. Ready?
Hang on, not yet, because I'm not sure where mute is.
Just mute here.
This one?
Yep. Oh, hold on.
Okay, there we go. Okay. Tell me when.
Let me turn my volume up. All the way. Okay. On your mark, get set, go.
Reading About Me is a beginning reading program specifically designed to hold the interest of visual learners. It can be used by parents, teachers, or anyone interested in teaching individuals of all ages to read. Unlike many beginning reading programs, Reading About Me focuses on customizing the reading process by allowing the user to tailor lessons with images and text meaningful to each individual learner. Using a powerful web-based program, Reading About Me allows uploading of personal words and photos to any of the 14 core lessons, as well as the ability to create unlimited additional custom lessons. Personalized word cards, picture cards, books, and practice materials are readily generated for each corresponding lesson. Data tracking and instant progress reports provide an easy and accurate measurement of reading growth. Add fun games, lots of praise, practice, and positive feedback, and you have a creative, solid, and successful foundation leading to a life full of reading for meaning, function, and pleasure. Reading About Me uses a sight word approach and teaches alphabet recognition and sound in context to the beginning word letters. By systematically teaching words that are meaningful to each learner, Reading About Me uniquely builds on successful implementation of critical steps needed to build a bridge to easy reader books and more traditional reading instruction. Each subscription includes full access for 12 months to the online program for one instructor and multiple assistants, each supporting one learner. Reading About Me has been successfully used with typically developing children, as well as children and adults with Down syndrome, on the autism spectrum, and other intellectual disabilities. As a fully accessible online program, collaboration between home, school, and while traveling is possible wherever internet is available, keeping the learner focused and delivery unified for each learner. Reading About Me can be purchased for a single learner, for home use, or in multiple license options for teachers, school districts, and nonprofit organizations, allowing quick lesson preparation and easy management and tracking of multiple students. Each subscription gives full program privileges for 12 months. Join our Reading About Me family risk-free with our 30-day money-back guarantee. Just click on the order tab and begin creating a lifetime of enrichment and personalized lessons for your learner today.
Somewhere. Oh, there it is.
Thank you, Representative Springer, for a really good idea.
Thank you. Excuse me, Madam Chair. I'm having a problem with my cable system at home. Are you available after session to...
No, but Representative Springer might be.
Yeah. Myself and my teenager only.
So you can see that Reading About Me, the crux of Reading About Me is all about personalizing learning. And I'm going to skip through some of these slides because I know we don't have a whole lot of time. I wanted to show you this one, though. We feel that traditional education is really content-based, and what we have discovered 10 years ago when we started working on this program is that the content-based solution wasn't reaching a lot of kids. And we worked with a bunch of people who had done research all across the country on various parts of reading and relationships, communicating partners. And what Reading About Me is really about is a relationship first to get to content through a relationship experience. On this slide, you can see, I'm sure it's one you're all familiar with, achievement gap. The students that we started out working with were students with disabilities, but what we found with Reading About Me and piloting it in schools with typically developing kids and ELL students is that it has, because of its personalized nature, where you can take anybody's personal life and turn it into words and pictures that are meaningful to them, that it has a powerful influence in talking about the cultural relevancy of somebody's life and teaching them about their own life. And that seems to spur interest in a way that content-based education alone does not do. These are some of the research that we've based the program on. I'm going to skip through this slide for now, but there's a lot of research coming out right now about right brain approach. And Reading About Me really uses a different approach than phonics-based learning. And we're phonics supporters, but we've understood in the kids that we're working with, a lot of times that is not something that's accessible to them. And going through a right brain approach where you're talking about pictures is something that resonates with them. And we've also found that it resonates with a lot of visual learners, which is a lot of kids. How does it work? We start by identifying significant people in someone's life. That can be parents, teachers, peers, child care providers, CASA appointed people. We go anywhere where there's somebody that touches that child's life, and we bring those people into our circle. And then we provide training for them. And our training goes from workshops to live demonstrations where they can bring their kid, and we work with the kids individually in front of a group of people to show what Reading About Me is all about. We also have a whole series of online training videos that anybody can access who uses the program. We complete a learner profile. Okay, that's not the slide that I wanted. Oh, how interesting. Okay. We complete a learner profile, gathering data on that individual. We do an initial assessment that captures that information for each child, and then we start collecting personal words for each child that we're working with. Next, we create a lesson. And let's see if we're going to get there. Okay, and the core lessons, there's 14 core template lessons, but the real power of this program is the create your own lesson. Because we follow the interest of the learner, the whole program is built on following where the learner wants to go. We create books on field trips, on vacations, on what's meaningful and relevant to that student's life. So for culturally diverse learners, it's a powerful program that takes what they already know. It's a strength that they already have, and we turn that into the method of a vehicle to learn. We add these personal words right here to a lesson. Every lesson is personalized to the learner. Here's their personal lessons, and the program automatically generates alphabet letters that go with the corresponding first letter of each word. We add pictures. We could combine those pictures to their word. Then we can create books and endless amounts of books. So each program allows for unlimited number of books to be produced. Here's an example of one of the books, Tiffany's IC book, and you can see the pages that you can create using their, now it's their family, their life, their experience. Then we can generate all the materials for a lesson. So each of these lessons can be generated continuously throughout the use of the program. And then we teach that lesson. So the online portion of our program is strictly that. It's to create personalized curriculum for learners that is high interest to those learners. And that's really the crux of it. And then the teaching is all personal. So when we say relationship-based, what we're talking about is that we're looking for one-on-one mentors for individuals to get this information across. That can be parents, that could be a teacher, that could be a peer mentor. And we're doing a lot of work right now in looking at students as peer mentors for other students who are falling behind or haven't gotten, come into the kindergarten system without the same level of support from their family situation. And I'm going to let Joyce.
I think what I want to say about the teaching piece is that in the videos, what I want to point out is...
And even though Deb introduced you, I need you to introduce your name for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Joyce Rogers.
Thank you, Joyce.
You're welcome. But I wanted to point out about the videos that was unscripted. Those kids were first time with us. We went to five different instructors and we said, hey, will you teach this program for the first time? And we went to parents of typically developing kids on the spectrum, kids with Down syndrome, and we said, will you bring your kids and can we just have fun with them with reading? And because it was personalized and it was fun, all those smiles that you saw in the video, totally unscripted. And so that's really a big piece in that building the relationship part and making it relevant to what's going on in their life. So I don't know if you want me to talk more on teaching.
So we're just flipping through the slides. I mean, some of these are how we actually teach the program. We won't have time to go into all of that. But as Joyce said, games are huge, right? We do the teaching is pretty straightforward. We use something called Match Select Name, which is also available if you want to learn more about it on our website. And then we play games, and we play lots of games. And parents play games with their kids. We get the parents playing games with kids. We get older siblings playing games with kids. And all these kids really are playing, and they just happen to be learning reading at the same time. So it's a little bit different than a traditional approach to teaching reading. Do you want to talk about this group?
So I do, but I also kind of wanted to talk about the part of the program itself offers that collaboration between home and school, because the program can be accessed by the parents or by the teachers. So that whole collaboration between home and school is really important to us and putting that piece together. And so we have built that into the system. So if a parent's at home, they can see exactly what their kids are working on at school, and they can also print the materials to work with them at home as well.
Another piece is once a learner learns a certain number of words, then they have access to online games, and these are all games with their words. So we have level 1, 2, and 3 that just refers to the number of distractor cards or number of word choices. So this is just some of the examples. We have book to word, we have pictures to word, so they can play lots of different games. The idea behind this is the more practice they have with words, the better they learn those words, and then we move on to the next set of things. And here's Emma sitting with her grandma reading her book. So most of our lessons end with the kids getting a book and that they can read. They keep those books. They read them over and over, and they share them with the people they know. And the last part of the program is to track progress. You want to talk about this?
Sure.
How we do it?
So at the end of each session, you can do an online probe. And so you'll see here where you have a green or a red button. So you can take any device. You can take an iPad, a phone, whatever it is, and just have the kid read to you the word that comes up. And that's how it's going to actually track the data. And so you would just click through. And right here, you'll see on the left hand the lesson words. So that's the entire lesson over here. In the center is the active words. We never work with more than 10 words at a time with kids. And over to the right are the acquired words. So once a child has gone through that probe, you'll see the bright red buttons at the end of each word, and that will identify they either got the word correct or they got it incorrect. And 5 out of 7 times it's considered an acquired word. And so this really tracks the whole lesson for you.
And then the last piece that teachers are very in favor of is the ability to print out at any given time how this child is doing, right? So you have the number of sessions, the instructional sessions. You have total minutes, what was included in this lesson of words. And remember, these are all personal lessons, right? So this is not a preset lesson coming from a book. This is actually words that have to do with this child's life. The games that we showed you, the online interactive games, are looked at. They record the number of games they play on their own. And again, anywhere they have access to internet, the library, school, home, on vacation, they can play their games. In the car, they can play their games. And then down here at the bottom. Oh, it's not going to the right one. There we go. Here we go. And down on the bottom, you can see all the results of the probe. So we have initial probe and then all the different probes after each instructional session. And so at any given time, you know exactly where that student is. These are some of the testimonials of families that we work with. We've been doing this program for quite some time, but the online version that you see today came out in July of 2013. We just want to take just one more minute, I think, and talk just a little bit about this last one. Thank you for this gift. My daughter is 19, and this is the first time she has ever read. And I want to say a little bit, and I want Joyce to talk a little bit. These parents that we worked with, I mean, if you saw what we saw in just shooting the video shots for this, for all the work that we do last summer in June, parents witnessed their kids reading for the first time, whether they were 19 or whether they were 4, and tears were streaming down faces. I mean, it's a powerful thing to teach a child to read. And I think one of the things that we've identified through our association with the Down Syndrome Association is reading is the door to everything. If we can teach kids to read, then they have access to books, they have access to learning, they have access to everything that you all represent in terms of education in Oregon. So we feel like the kids that are falling off the wagon, the achievement gap kids, those are the kids that we want to work with. We are passionate about working with those kids. We think we can help those kids. We think that if you do a relationship-based program, that will reach those kids in a way that traditional education hasn't. And we're looking now to we're actually partnering with SOU, Central Point School District, Southern Oregon Head Start, and Family Nurturing Center to put together a grant for the Kindergarten Readiness and Innovation Grant that you all helped happen by the governor last fall. And we're grateful for that opportunity. We think that innovation is needed in Oregon, and we are happy to be at the table trying to get programs like this where they need to be. Sorry, I didn't like to say anything.
No, you're fine.
And I've got to ask you to start to summarize, so I'm sorry.
Actually, probably we can just take questions. I think
that's
covered.
Okay. Is that okay? Did you have one more slide that you want to take?
I think we're good.
You
share
sure?
Stories all day.
Okay.
But if there's any questions, we would be happy to take them, and then we're...
Excellent. Are there Representative Reardon?
Most of the images had looked like one-on-one. Is that normal, or was that for the sake of the video?
Most of the work that we do is one-on-one. Teachers work in small groups, so groups of 3 to 5 that we've worked with. One of the things that we're looking at is to keep the children that are the middle schoolers, high schoolers that are falling off of the edge. We want to work on using peers as the helpful vehicle to actually teach kids that are younger. And that's one of the things that we're putting together in the grant that we want to do. So our program does require a one-on-one relationship at part of the program, and then there's a lot of play and joint activities that can happen. But the actual teaching moment of those personal words happens one-on-one, and then the play can happen in endless groups, if that answers your question.
Very good. Thank you.
Further questions? Well, thank you very much
thank
for coming
you very
to share
much
this.
For
I think it's, I agree with you that reading really is that cornerstone. And for some learners, I think we too early in the process decide that kids can't read because they haven't hit a certain benchmark by the time they're in the first grade or the third grade or the fifth grade. And I think that we know that the single biggest predictor of a child not learning to read is not teaching them.
Right.
And so as soon as we stop teaching them, that is what preordains that they aren't going to achieve literacy. So I think the story of the 19-year-old reading for the first time is really important. We can't give up on any of these kids learning. We're all always learning.
Right. Forever. Well, we've worked with 3 to 55. So we don't, and it works. It's magic. It's very exciting. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much. All right. Our next panel. And can we pull up a fourth chair so they can all come together? Is that okay? Yeah. So we have Diana Sticker, Maura Finnegan, Maria Baker, and Jen Capalonga. And if I didn't say any of the names right, I apologize. Welcome. And if you could start by introducing yourself for the record when you each speak, that helps us meet our rules around here, I guess.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the House and Education Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Diana Sticker. I'm a parent and founding member of an organization called Decoding Dyslexia Oregon. With me today are 3 other members of Decoding Dyslexia Oregon. I would like to introduce to you Maria Baker, a parent, Jen Capalonga, a teacher and a parent, and Moira Finnegan is a speech-language pathologist with Portland Public Schools. We come before you today representing our 500 members and families of Decoding Dyslexia Oregon, some of which children are on that slide. The title of our talk today is Addressing Dyslexia, Key to Achieving Oregon's Educational Goals. Decoding Dyslexia is part of a national movement. This movement started in New Jersey by a group of parents 2 years ago that were traveling on a train from a New York City luncheon on dyslexia. As they chatted throughout the day, they noticed similar stories between their school districts. They were all from different parts of the state. They met with great challenge, effective instruction for their children. By the time they got off the train, they decided to form a group. 1 year ago, Oregon became the 5th state to join Decoding Dyslexia, and just this year, we have grown to 45 state groups. The mission they formed on the train is the same one Decoding Dyslexia continues to follow today. We aim to raise dyslexia awareness, empower families to support their children, and share our stories to help policymakers ensure students with dyslexia and their teachers have the resources they need to succeed. By speaking today, we hope to encourage legislation that addresses dyslexia. For me, the exact moment I decided to become involved in the movement was after a 504 plan meeting for my daughter. Our special education teacher asked my private tutor for a good book on dyslexia. You see, even though he graduated just 5 years prior, he didn't receive instruction on dyslexia. I knew my daughter would be fine because she was receiving private, evidence-based tutoring specifically tailored for dyslexia. I became concerned for other students in our community and their teachers. The absence of appropriate teacher training in dyslexia is and continues to be a serious problem. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Capalonga, and I am from Portland. I hope to shed light on a little-known and hidden educational equity issue in our state. I'll do so by sharing the story of my son, Garrett. The beginning of Garrett's story is the same as thousands of children in Oregon's public schools. Garrett was distressed in first grade when, despite his tremendous effort, he was not learning to read. I, as his mother, practiced and practiced with him, but he struggled. I'm also a trained special education teacher with a master's in education, so I used all my training to help him, but he continued to make minimal progress. There began to be talk among the teachers at his school that the standards were too high for children like Garrett, and I was terrified for my son. The part where Garrett's story begins to differ from thousands of children in Oregon is when at age 7, he was diagnosed by a private educational psychologist as moderately dyslexic. Garrett's educational psychologist recommended that the best practice for someone with dyslexia was Orton-Gillingham tutoring. Since Garrett's public school did not offer this type of evidence-based instruction, we resorted to private tutoring for Garrett. He has received tutoring twice a week for 2 years. Because this type of instruction matches his neuroanatomy, he has thrived. Today he has learned the tools he needs to succeed in the classroom. He is happy and confident, and he has even exceeded the standard in both reading and math on the OAKS exam. I come before you today to say that not providing these evidence-based instructions to Oregon students is an equity issue. Many parents who have concerns about the current state of education for dyslexic children in Oregon do not have the luxury of speaking before you on a Monday afternoon, nor the ability to pay for private tutoring when appropriate instruction is not provided in the schools. I want you to know that the story of Oregon's dyslexic students is not hopeless. There is scientifically proven methodology to provide our children with the free and appropriate education that they are entitled to. These methods can be taught in a cost-effective way to all students. On behalf of Oregon's children, I implore you to seriously examine this issue, to consult with qualified experts, and formulate a plan which will bring these methods to Oregon schools. By addressing the issue of dyslexia, we can bring Oregon out of the red and drastically improve graduation rates, dropout rates, and absenteeism. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and committee members, for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Moira Finnegan, and I am a speech-language pathologist with Portland Public Schools, as well as a founding member of Decoding Dyslexia Oregon. I'd like to start by sharing the definition of dyslexia with you. Dyslexia is a specific learning disability that is neurological in origin. That means the brains of students with dyslexia are wired differently than students without dyslexia. This difference in brain wiring is strongly influenced by genetics, so dyslexia runs in families. So if you have a parent or a sibling with dyslexia, you have a 50% chance of having dyslexia. Dyslexia is characterized by difficulties with accurate and or fluent word recognition and by poor spelling and decoding abilities. This means that even when they work hard at it, students with dyslexia still have trouble learning how to read and spell. These difficulties typically result from a deficit in the phonological component of language. This means that students with dyslexia have a hard time mapping the sounds of spoken language to the symbols of written language, namely letters and words. This slide shows differences in brain function between non-impaired readers and people with dyslexia. In the non-impaired reader, three key areas of the brain light up during reading. In people with dyslexia, however, two of these three brain areas show minimal or no activity during reading. The good news is that effective instruction can change the wiring of the brain in students with dyslexia. Current brain research shows that after effective instruction, the brains of students with dyslexia light up in all three areas, just like the brains of proficient readers. Dyslexia is more common than you might think. Between 5 and 20% of school-aged children have dyslexia. This translates to between 28,000 and 112,000 students with dyslexia in Oregon public schools. 80% of students with a specific learning disability have dyslexia. It's important to note that dyslexia occurs on a spectrum. Some students are mildly affected, while others are more severely impacted. Sadly, the consequences of failing to provide effective instruction to students with dyslexia leads to outcomes that are all too familiar. 32% of fourth graders and 22% of eighth graders nationwide have below basic reading skills. A study by the Department of Justice showed that 68% of state prison inmates do not have a high school diploma, and of those, 66% have a learning disability. In contrast, children with higher reading skills at age 7 have higher incomes, better housing, and more professional roles in adulthood. Given the importance of early reading skills on life outcomes, we need to identify students with dyslexia no later than first grade so we can provide effective reading instruction that is matched to their unique neurology. I'd like to tell you a story about how I became passionate about addressing the needs of students with dyslexia. My first year on the job, which was 3 years ago, I had a fifth grade student who transferred to my caseload from a special school for children with the most challenging behavior problems. At my first meeting with him, he said to me, "Can I tell you a secret?" And I said, "Nope. I just met you. You can hang on to your secret. You can tell me next time." It turns out that his secret was, "I can't read." I felt bad he could have told me that. He was a fifth grader, but he was reading and writing at the kindergarten level. He had behavior issues, which may well have developed as a way to divert attention from the fact that he couldn't read. But he had shown the courage to tell me his secret in the hopes that someone would finally teach him how to read. I was shocked and perplexed as to how this student had made it all the way from kindergarten to fifth grade and had never learned how to read. I sought out specialized training on dyslexia, and my suspicions were confirmed. The student was suffering from severe dyslexia that had remained undiagnosed and untreated all these years. How is it possible that not a single educator among all those who had worked with this student over the years had missed the clear signs of dyslexia? I came to realize there is a gaping hole in services within our school system, and thousands of kids like this student are suffering because of it. The gaping hole in services is the type of reading instruction provided to kids with dyslexia. It is important for these children with dyslexia to be taught by a sequenced, systematic, and explicit method that involves several senses at the same time. When given this type of reading instruction, students with dyslexia can learn to read. This graphic shows a relationship between classroom instruction and intensive tutoring for students with dyslexia. When classroom instruction does not meet the needs of students with dyslexia, there is a greater need for intensive tutoring to bring these students' reading skills up to grade level. When classroom instruction in reading is multisensory, sequenced, and explicit, the need for intensive tutoring is decreased. If we are smart enough to start early intervention with these children by first grade, the expected incidence of reading disability can be drastically reduced. Without early intervention, between 12 and 18% of students will be diagnosed with a reading disability and will be at risk for negative life outcomes. However, with effective early intervention, that percentage can be reduced to as low as 1.6% of students. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics, children identified as reading disabled after second grade rarely catch up to their peers. We know that third grade students who are not reading at grade level are four times less likely to earn a high school diploma. For students living in poverty, reading below grade level in third grade makes them 12 times less likely to graduate from high school. We have to reach these kids by first grade in order to give them the best chance of graduating from high school, which will in turn give them the best chances of succeeding in life. I want to say in the strongest possible terms that dyslexia is an equity issue. Parents of the students that I work with in North Portland will never be able to afford the private evaluations or tutoring that Jen was able to provide for her son. Many families trust that the public school system will do right by their children, that educators have the necessary knowledge and skills to teach all children how to read. In reality, we educators are not given the tools we need in our teacher preparation programs to recognize and treat dyslexia in our students. The unfortunate result is thousands of students like the one I met who could not read in fifth grade and who perhaps never will. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair Gelsler and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Maria Baker and I'm from Portland. With our last slide, I would like to share the ideas we have for legislation. But first, I'd like to share my personal connection to dyslexia. My father had dyslexia, and it was unidentified for him until he was nearly unable to graduate from high school. I was told he struggled in school. He died in his 60s after spending his whole life unable to read past a first grade level. He was a beautiful and intelligent person who always said his greatest gifts were his three daughters. As a young woman, when I would visit him in his apartment, he would sometimes ask me to write his checks for him. Numbers were difficult for him to spell. He had a reference sheet, but it was easier if I did it for him. Because of this experience, I was especially eager to introduce my children to books and reading beginning at birth. Because of this experience, we do not have a television in our home. My children attended both preschool and kindergarten. Not surprisingly, one of them resisted learning the alphabet. By teachers and neighbors, I was told he was a boy. He would develop at his own natural rate. But by the end of the first grade, he was still struggling with the symbols and the corresponding sounds of the alphabet. I happened to come across an ad for a reading tutor, and my son received private tutoring from an Orton-Gillingham certified tutor. Today, in the fourth grade, Ethan reads for pleasure, and he earns very good grades. He is still an emerging speller. This is something that will improve with time, but as it should be, Ethan is able to fully participate in his fourth grade curriculum. Too many children with dyslexia go through school without proper support. To ensure Oregon children have the resources and opportunities they need to succeed in school, we would like to see a universal definition and understanding of dyslexia, early screening for dyslexia, evidence-based remediation programs for students who show signs of dyslexia, teacher training for all teachers to include the International Dyslexia Association's knowledge and practice standards. And for the children who may continue to struggle even after appropriate intervention, we'd like to see access to assistive technologies. Decoding Dyslexia Oregon, as well as our partner organizations, would be happy to work towards a solution with you. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you for a fantastic presentation. That was really well done. What questions do we have for this panel? Representative Huffman.
First of all, I want to thank Maria. I now have a phrase I can use. I'm an emerging speller. So no more complaints from you guys. So are you working with somebody in the legislature? Have you identified somebody?
Not yet. This is our first day.
Okay. And I appreciated you coming and doing a pre-meeting with me. And so hopefully we can help you come up with a plan for 2015 to have a bill concept.
Thank you. That would be wonderful.
More questions? Oh.
Representative
Wismet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, are we going to have anyone from ODE talk about how they handle this situation?
Representative Wisnett, I should have learned by now to check with you before the hearings to figure out who we should invite. But no, we don't have them on the schedule today, but we could ask them to come back sometime. And ODE is giving me a thumbs up. Would that work?
Yes, I think that meant Jan thought she's ready to answer.
Representative Huffman thinks you're ready to take this all on right now. I think we'll get a better presentation later.
Thank you.
And we could probably take Jan some cookies. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm a little surprised there isn't a universally accepted definition for dyslexia. Because I noticed that was, like, I think number one on your goals or your outcomes or mm-hmm. whichever that slide was. Mm-hmm. So is that true? Sorry.
No, that's okay.
Didn't mean to stump anybody, but I'm just really surprised at that.
I think familiarity with the condition of dyslexia varies widely. Unfortunately, for the most part, like I said, in our teacher training programs, we don't get a lot of instruction at all. In my two-year graduate program, I had one class presentation that included the concept of dyslexia. Dyslexia is mentioned in the federal IDEA information about specific learning disabilities, so it's included in, as an example of a specific learning disability in IDEA. I guess I'll just say that my concern is that in practice, educators both within general education and special education don't know dyslexia when they see it. So when a child shows clear red flags that indicate that they have this neurology that makes it difficult for them to match sounds to symbols, that they should know straight away, oh, this looks like dyslexia, and then they should have the depth of knowledge and information about what's going to work to help this child learn to read. I think in my short experience in the school system, that's what's missing. It's just knowing it when you see it and knowing what to do about it when you see it.
Thank you. So that helps me out a lot. So it's less of an issue of a definition of it, but it's more of an issue of understanding and how, when there's been a professional diagnosis, how to respond to it and an equipping of that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I would... I'm sorry.
No, you're fine.
I would also just suggest that it could be that the best offense is a good defense, that if we were to use a structured systematic multisensory curriculum for all students in kindergarten, first, and second, then we can drastically reduce, we can weed out the kids who will respond to that level of instruction and end up with just 1.6 to 6% of kids who need intensive tutoring, as opposed to the 12 to 18% of kids who end up in third grade as marked as needing that sort of intensive tutoring.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Either one of you, do pediatricians, do they help try to identify this? Is there something in a test that a pediatrician? We just, we passed a bill, many members of this committee, about visual screening so that the parent comes in to the school telling them my child has this learning disability or something. And this was on visual screening. So do your pediatricians, are they qualified to identify this and help you? Or?
Who wants to answer? My question. Okay.
It's kind of interesting because pediatricians, for the most part, don't receive this information as part of their training. While the source of the difficulty is in the brain wiring, I think it's considered more of an educational, if you were to ask, more of an educational issue if you're to ask pediatricians. Sometimes parents and families get caught in a sort of a ping pong game where the school says talk to your pediatrician says talk to your school, and neither group really owns the problem. I think probably as things stand now, it's neuropsychologists in the community who are probably best equipped to do the evaluations necessary to come up with a diagnosis of dyslexia.
Can I answer that?
Of course.
But it is a good point about pediatricians because parents and pediatricians are the first. There are red flags that can be caught before children come to school. So I feel as though it would be a good benefit for pediatricians to also know the red warning, or we're talking about red flags or warning signs as well. And one of the references we use as parents is actually from a book from a pediatrician. It's called Overcoming Dyslexia. And a lot of the work Sally Shaywitz did is on brain research as well. So there is a connection. There should be a connection, really. The warning signs just doesn't belong to the schools as well. It belongs to parents, community members, and their pediatricians, actually. That's my belief.
Madam Chair, would suggest that we not only have ODE, but have some pediatrician or someone come in and say, how could they or why they're not identifying this so it can be attention given to it as early as possible. Now, back to... I remember many, many years ago when my son was born, he had hip dysplasia, and they used to not test children for this. That's a matter of when they're born, they just set them down the table and do their little legs to see if they go in and out without problems. And they used to never identify it at birth, and then later they would have problems of bad legs and walking difficulties and all that. But it's just a test that the pediatrician does at birth for hip dysplasia now.
I didn't like watching that test.
Yeah.
So we've got Representative Parrish and then Representative Fagan, and then we're going to have to wrap up.
Okay, well, I just want to answer Rep. Wisnett's question a little bit as well, having been through this process. We don't have enough neuropsychs. They certainly are not out in the rural parts of the state. So you're talking about parents who, if the schools aren't trained, they're having to schlep their kid up to OHSU. The wait list at OHSU is months and months and months long. And then that's only if your insurance covers it. So there's some other, I think, more bigger dynamic conversations around is this education or is it healthcare, when it, look at who's delivering the services, and pediatricians, if they're good, you know, can step in and help fill that gap. But I have to imagine that some of you are parents. It took a long time to get through that process, and in the meantime, what's happening is you're losing valuable education time if this isn't, you know, second and third grade, and they're falling, you know, feasibly, you know, 2 to 3 years behind, just trying to get through that process. And for our own process, trying to figure out with one of our children, it was literally about a two-year process. And we don't have dyslexia, but we certainly had some other learning issues going on.
Thank you.
Representative Paris. Representative Fagan.
So I just physically joined you, but I was up in my office multitasking for my other job and watching the hearing on my closed-circuit television. So I just want to say fantastic job. I'm very interested in, as Representative Huffman said, you know, working towards a bill concept in 2015. And I'm a mom myself, and watching all of you makes me remember that never underestimate the ferocity of moms advocating on behalf of their children. So great work, great presentation. I look forward to working with Representative Huffman and others in the 2015 session.
Thank you. And thank you all very much for your work and a great presentation. Thank you very much. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the... With that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on improving boosting literacy and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 1509. And...
The
sheet's over here.
Got it.
All right, so we are back in a public hearing on Senate Bill 1509, and I would like to invite Michael Mason and Justin Martin, please. And Craig. No. Who else got skipped over? Okay. Great. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the House Education Committee. My name is Michael Mason. For the record, I reside in Portland. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Tsleil-Waututh, who, as you may know, have a charter school where they still use the name Tsleil-Waututh Valley Warriors. I want to say they are in support of this bill, of course, supported the bill last year, and are acceptable to the compromise, primarily because it does send the Board of Education back to have consultation with all the 9 federally recognized tribes. That is a critical point. And I just want to make the point that 3 minutes of testimony is not consultation. There needs to be a longer discussion. And that will happen under this bill. And that's very important. It's not just important for mascots. It's important to resume a conversation about curriculum that's very important, as Senator Cruz mentioned. So it's important for government to government. Tsleil-Waututh Valley Warriors issue will be taken care of, as I understand it, though this is a process and everybody gets to weigh in on the rulemaking. Just because there's consultation with tribes doesn't mean the rest of the public, I mean, they certainly will participate in this, native and non-native. So, again, thank you for bringing this forward, and I also want to thank the governor for working with us on this and coming to a compromise that where we all gave something. But I think it sets a process in place that will be very valuable for education of Native children in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. We are here in full support of Senate Bill 1509. As you heard from Michael, we're very proud of the government-to-government process. We're very proud of what we've been able to accomplish along with the state in working on things like deletion of squaw language from Oregon geographic board names, working on illegally held archaeological objects, working on state-certified tribal police officers, and with last session, the passage of this bill to allow school districts and tribes to work together towards an agreement to do the right thing when it comes to imagery and the mascot issue. So we thank you very much for your time. We'll be brief. I know you want to hear from folks. But what we'd like to really focus on today is the fact that we were able to sit down with the governor's office, go through something that we both could agree with, something that will be representative of all 9 federally recognized tribes, help answer the questions on the front end, so when these issues happen, tribes and school districts automatically can start to have those discussions. And as I talked about before on the Senate side, the real issue that we'd like to get to here is let's move forward. I've shared with you an education study that we did that showed how tribal youth from the 9 federally recognized tribes are faring here in Oregon, and as we all know, it probably, well, we now know for sure, we're not doing very well. So we'd like to get past this, open those lines of communication, start that dialogue with the school districts, and actually work on something that's going to make a difference. We want to educate students, tribal and non-tribal, as to the value of tribal governments in Oregon, why we're a part of the everyday fabric of Oregon life, and what it means to be tribal, and what it means for all of us to be a community together, sharing our past and utilizing that towards the future. So thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today, and we look forward to working with you again.
I was going to say, any questions for these two, Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Justin, you said something important, but I want to clarify a distinction. You talked about a community and working on things together, but would you say that it's true, because you and Michael both have worked with a number of the tribes for many years, is it a fair characterization to say that all of the tribes do not agree on everything all the time or something? There's not complete unanimity all the time. Is that a fair...
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, that's absolutely true, and it's absolutely true of any representative government. Marion County, Polk County, Lane County, Multnomah County don't always agree. Oregon, Washington, Idaho, California don't always have agreements. The nice thing about this bill is it actually requires the State Board of Education to sit down and have that consultation piece with the 9 federally recognized tribes. And let's not forget, in terms of representative government, every citizen, tribal or non-tribal, that lives here in Oregon has that representative government in their state representative or their school board, and even within their tribe, even if they're not here in Oregon. So they have that recourse to talk to their own tribe and say, hey, for example, when I'll leave it at that. But again, representative government, I think, is a good thing, and we certainly see it here in Oregon.
Follow up. And I thank both of you for all the work that has gone into this, as well as Representative Springer and Senator Cruz and a bunch of others. The reason I point that out is because sometimes we have heard some testimony in this committee that Native Americans were representing all Native Americans. And I wanted to point out that the ones that I represent could very possibly have a different feeling on this bill than some that we have had come and testify here. And I just want to point out, there is not complete agreement within the community. So, thank you.
Thank you. Further questions for this panel? Representative Fagan.
Thank you. I am just curious. I know we've talked a lot about process, and I sit behind Representative Springer on the floor, so I've gotten little updates kind of all throughout in the year leading up to the bill that we passed last session and this one. So can you just give me an example? So I'm actually a graduate of the Dalles High School in Representative Huffman's district, which is the Dalles High School Indians. It now is Eagle Indians or something, but when I was there, it was just before the high schools merged. Can you give me just an example of kind of what the process looks like? So let's take the Dalles High School, for example, and let's say it's still the circa 1999 Dalles High School. What does this process look like? Kind of step one, step two, step three, just so I can kind of actually picture the process, that would be helpful to me.
Well, sure. Madam Chair, Representative Fagan, in terms of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, we would have contact with that school district. In this case, let's say Malala, because that's within Grand Ronde's original territory. The Malala Band of Indians were one of 29 that were originally moved to the Grand Ronde Reservation. So we would have that contact, we would reach out, and we would start to actually work on what that agreement would look like. Now, in the current bill that you have, those agreements would start to be worked on with the Board of Education and between the 9 tribes in consultation, so that we could actually look at what is meaningful or significant to the tribe, and then we can also look at things like imagery. What kind of imagery would be acceptable? What would be okay? And to be frank, the current imagery with Malala, we would have to definitely take a look at. So we would certainly have that communication up front. Then we would work through the process with the state to get that rule established. Once that rule is established, the state must approve these agreements, and then we would sit down with that school district. We would also then selfishly utilize that opportunity as one to say, okay, here's where we're going in terms of mascots and the Malala Indians, but here's where we'd like to go in the future in terms of education. Here's what we would like you to teach your students. Here's what we'd like our students in your school districts to know about themselves. This is what we'd like to take into the future and really start to attack some of those problems that I talked about earlier in terms of education. So it would be an open process, one of open communication, and that's how we would go about this.
And if I may, Chair Gelser and members of the committee, Michael Mason again, Representative Fagan, of course, the Dalles is a very, very important place to Warm Springs. About a mile up the hill from the current city limits was the Treaty Oak. That's where the Treaty of Middle Oregon of 1855 was negotiated. The 3 days of negotiation with a person who would later go on to be Speaker of the House of Oregon, Joel Palmer. And so we might start, what do you mean we, white man, you may say? Fair enough. But the Warm Springs might start with, here is the place where we negotiated our treaty. This is an important place to us. And you need to know how many villages were around here and how much fishing took place and still takes place and so forth. You know, so you start with my experience with Warm Springs elders, and you've had some of this experience, I think all of you or most of you has had some experience with tribal elders. You don't start today, and you don't start a few years ago. You start back a ways and to get the background, and that's a process in itself, how you talk about history. So so I agree with Justin's comments, but I think you can start on the discussion of what's culturally acceptable and appropriate right away. We don't plan to wait for the Board of Ed to pass rules to do that.
Thank you very much. All right, thank you both.
Representative
Reardon, sorry.
I'm still looking around. So, as I mentioned earlier, I've just struggled so hard with this, and it is hard because I respect everybody that's involved so much. And I know we're all trying to reach this, a goal. But so please bear with me. In the discussions that you've had and the mascots that you're considering or that are in use, do you consider those to be racist?
Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, I have not looked at all those mascots. It will certainly be part of the process when Grand Ron sits down to analyze what is going on with that school district within their Aboriginal territory. In looking at some of those, they may well be not culturally acceptable, or they might be culturally acceptable. Again, we will determine that when we sit down and start to have those discussions. There will also be the open discussion portion during the Board of Education's rulemaking process.
Could you comment? If you can do that, if you can come up and assure people, not just me, but people in general, that the mascots are not racist and they're not offensive to large numbers of Native Americans in the state, then you got my vote. But that's I'm just really concerned about it.
Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, I think we certainly hear your sentiments. And I think the reality here is there needs to be some trust. And there needs to be trust in the 9 federally recognized tribes that we understand and will do the right thing when it comes to what is culturally appropriate for our people, for our citizens, for our communities, and for the state of Oregon. We've got a wonderful track record. And we want to continue that in the future because we've got way bigger issues on the horizon that we need to be looking at today. So, as I, a tribal person, watched Florida State University and the Seminole Tribe negotiate, I had faith and I had trust in the Seminole Tribe to do what's right for their people and ultimately what's right for that community and that state. So I would ask that the state has a little trust in the 9 federally recognized tribes to do what's right going into the future.
Okay. And one last.
Of course.
And actually, on a positive note, I love the idea that we could actually start advocating for a true representation of the history and of the Native Americans, and that would be a wonderful outcome. So I'm very positive on that, one, no matter what. So
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Sam Sachs. Oh, sorry, Representative Gorsuch, I missed you.
Okay, I will now go to a different place, and I want to read something to you and see what you respond to in terms of this. Because I'm a social scientist, I come from a research background. I think research is extremely important. This is from the American Psychological Association. In 2005, the American Psychological Association called for the immediate retirement of all American Indian mascots, symbols, images, and personalities by schools, colleges, universities, athletic teams, and organizations. APA's position is based on a growing body of social science literature that shows the harmful effects of racial stereotyping and inaccurate racial portrayals, including the particularly harmful effects of American Indian sports mascots on the social identity, development, and self-esteem of American Indian young people. Now, I know that's a national organization, but we are part of the United States. What is your response to that in terms of this question of trust?
If I may, Chair Gelser and Representative Gorsuch. So the experience of the Siletz tribe is primarily with the Siletz warriors. There was a high school that was there, you know, starting 80 years ago or so. With all the consolidations and cutbacks in funding and everything, the kids now or would have to all go to Toledo. But they managed to, thanks to the legislature and the flexibility of charter schools, they have the Siletz Valley Charter School. So the mascot, I can't say what the mascot or what the imagery was 80 years ago. I don't know that. But I can say that for the charter school, the imagery has been chosen by that community, which is primarily, I believe it's 80% Native. I believe it's even 80% Siletz, and then some other tribes and some non-Indians as well. So I don't think, when I think about the, and I certainly have been exposed to these mascots too, when I think about the mascots that the, and the process for selecting those mascots that the Psychiatric Association is talking about, or, you know, there's a couple of things at play here. One is, it's pretty clear to me that those mascots, there was no Native input into the selection of those mascots, and that's demeaning in itself. And back to the racist, are they racist? Well, a bunch of them, yeah, were, are. I think that's right. I think when you have a community, I think it's more analogous to the pride that many of us have in our ethnic heritage, when you have the tribe itself select the imagery. And I cite the example of the place where my folks and I were born, having Scottish blood, we were born in Longview. Well, right next door is the Kelso Highlanders, and we're proud of that. The Highlanders, sometimes there are really negative stereotypes about the Highlanders. Don't get me wrong. I mean, people are cheap and they're whatnot. There's some various things, but you know, that are negative. But the idea of the strength of the people, you know, facing English oppression, those are stories I grew up with as a child. I think it's more analogous to, is that a negative? It can be used negatively. It certainly can. And ethnic jokes, we've all heard them for everybody, you know, every group. And it's, you know, they can be quite disgusting. But I think the key here is the respect of a process, you know, that you're setting in motion. And I believe that today in Oregon, I don't think this was true 80 years ago, maybe probably even 50 years ago, that the school district folks, the tribal leaders, you know, they'll get together in a sense of mutual respect and be able to work something out that is not demeaning, is not negative. So, and of course, it's a law you're passing, and it's a law you get to amend. So he'll be involved in the process if something goes awry.
Follow up. So what do I say to the many non-affiliated people that I've received emails from saying, I am not a mascot? What are we supposed to say to those people? I think they raise a valid point. They're not mascots. Some of them feel that it's a horrendous thing to be depicted that way, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, I think, again, Chair Gelser and Representative Gorsuch, it's hard. I will say it's hard for me to understand fully the feeling of being treated that way. It is difficult. I would say this. The Board of Ed is going to do its rulemaking with testimony. They took testimony from everybody before that wanted to testify. They'll do so again. The school districts who are engaged, and you can quickly identify all the school districts that have these high schools. There's not a ton of them. It's maybe a dozen school districts or so. They have a public process that they got to go through on this, too. It's not just they sit down in a closed room with the cigars and work it out with Justin here, you know, or with me, and that's not going to happen, you know. But so there will be a public process with that. So I think that they'll participate in that. So okay. Yes.
Thank you, thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome. Further comments? I'm sorry that I didn't see you down there before.
That's all right. No problem.
Anybody else? Thank you both very much.
Yeah, thanks very much.
All right, Sam, facts, please. Hey, Sam, welcome back.
Chair Gelser, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. If I can just have one moment to gather my thoughts here.
Okay. Hello. My name is Sam Sachs, and I am a human rights commissioner for the city of Portland, Oregon, and I'm here to speak to you, Chair, members of the committee, today about Senate Bill 1509. I know I only have a short time, so I want to just follow up on a few things that were talked about. First, Chair and Representative Fagan, actually your high school is already in the process of changing their mascot. If you look, there's an article that was out on December 13th, says new mascot choices for Dallas Wantaka High. Is that where you went?
The Dallas Wantaka High.
Yeah. And some of their suggestions are Rattlers, Rapids, Sasquatch, Megawatts, Riverhawks. So your school's already in the process of changing their mascot. I'm here today to really talk about three issues, and I'll make it brief. The first is education and students. In 2005-2006, two students, Shea Butler, Louis Whitebear, came forward to the Board of Education. They expressed that they felt discriminated against, harassed, and bullied based on the Native American mascots that were represented at their schools and other schools traveling to and from. They brought this issue to the Board of Education. There was a thorough process that was done. There was a research, 39-page research paper that was presented to some of you. I think hopefully all of you have read it. And inside that research, as you've stated, the American Psychological Institute, the American Sociological Institute, the Anti-Defamation League, the Civil Rights Commission in 1964, the ACLU, the NAACP, lists of human rights, civil rights organizations have called for the elimination of Native American mascots. Nowhere in any of their calls, nowhere in the 39-page report does it state appropriate use of mascots. And let's just say that this is about race-based mascots. It's not just Native American mascots. We're talking about pride and honor. I'm Jewish. Been Jewish my whole life. Born, live, gonna die Jew. Proud as anybody. I would never buy off on any school having a Jewish mascot, whether I'm okay with it or not, because it affects so many other people and so many other students, and I'm not okay with it. Nor would anybody buy off on the Beaverton Blacks, the Lake Oswego Latinos, any of that. I want to focus on the education piece. In that paper, the 39-page report, there states testimony from students, testimony from tribal members, all those institutes, specifically that these mascots are damaging to Native American students. They impact their self-esteem. They impact their pride. They cause bullying, harassment, and demeaning. And the reason I bring that to you is because these students go to our schools in Oregon. And as a state and as a board, legislative board, and the governor, we have the responsibility to protect each student. Whether you think the mascot's appropriate or I think it's appropriate, we have the responsibility to protect all students. I feel that there's overwhelming evidence here from this report and from all the institutes and many tribal members, and let's just be fair, not all nine tribes are on board with this agreement. That's not factually accurate. In fact, some tribes have spoken out against this bill. Some are neutral. Some haven't spoken at all. So to present that all nine tribes are on board with a compromise, it's not accurate. So that's the education piece. The second piece I want to get to, and I can answer questions, more questions as well, is this. I have a map for you here. The way the literature in the bill reads is that any federally recognized tribe in the state of Oregon can give permission to a school to use that federally recognized tribe's image, logo, or mascot. So if you look at this, you have the Burns Paiute over here on this side of the state. If this school here goes to the community and the Burns Paiute tribe and says, we'd like to use your endorsement, use a mascot, and the community and the tribe says, we're not okay with that. We don't want to do that. The way the bill's read, it reads right now, is they could come over here to Grand Ron or Celeste, who is on record as supporting this, and get permission to use Grand Ron or Celeste's tribe as their mascot over here. So that's problematic because this impacts this whole community who may or may not go on record as saying we don't support this. We don't want to have these mascots in our school. So I think at the very least, if you are so compelled to pass this bill, I think there should be an amendment to speak specifically to the local community, meaning that the local community, Lebanon, Roseburg, whatever school, has to get permission from that federally recognized tribe. Some people have said, well, we're going to leave that up to the Oregon Board of Education to put in their rules. Let me remind you that this is the same Board of Education that has voted 5-1 to eliminate the use of mascots. So, and some of my talking and discussions with people, no one's consulted with the Board of Education or the members and asked them what their feeling about this compromise is, what the rules are going to look like, and as the testimony you heard today, they have no idea what it's going to look like. So I think it's a bad road to go down. We've been up this path for 8 years, excuse me, to get to this place to eliminate the use of Native American mascots. It doesn't do it justice in 5 weeks to overturn that and go back to the same business as usual with having these race-based mascots in our school. And it's going to impact students. Now, students are going to be bullied, they're going to be harassed, regardless of if you pass this bill or not. But the state and the Board of Education can send a message that we are not going to be a part of that. You can still do consultation, you can still talk to tribes, you can still form relationships, you can do all the things that have been discussed without the use of mascots. And I would offer one last thing. If we're talking about compromise, if we're talking about working together in government relationships and all that stuff, which I think is great, then the ban doesn't go into place until 2017. So between now and 2017, if no one wants to believe the 39-page report and all the overwhelming evidence that supports the elimination of bans of these mascots, then I would call and ask the governor, Kitzhaber, publicly here today, to put together a task force. Members of all nine tribes, members of the Board of Education, to do a study and a research to see about the impact and the effect that these race-based mascots have on students. Before you vote today to overturn that, I think that's our responsibility. That it's a win-win situation. mascots still stay in place until 2017, and we can really work together with the tribes, we can work together with each other to do a study and research and to see if what this 39-page report says is accurate. Lastly, I want to add that the word compromise to me has been interesting. As I think about the civil rights movement, when black people were wanting to stay in the same restaurants or eat in the same restaurants and stay in the same hotel, go to the same schools, they were fighting for equality. They weren't fighting for a compromise. They weren't saying that we want to go to the schools on Saturdays and Sunday when the white kids aren't there. We want equality. We want to be treated as everyone else. This compromise actually compromises the Native American students and other students' ability to go to school and learn in an environment that is free of racism and discrimination. So I would ask that you vote no, or at least amend the bill. And again, I would ask the governor to create a task force before we move forward on this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any brief questions for Mr. Sachs?
Huffman, Representative Huffman, and I will not miss Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you. I don't know. First of all, Sam, short 5 weeks. This topic has not been short 5 weeks. You and I both know that. So saying that on the record is a little bit disingenuous because this is from last session and it's been a long conversation. Had many, many, many hearings, hours and hours of testimony. A lot of this is a local control issue. One size does not fit all. I'm offended by reports saying that every school that has a Native American mascot is being discriminatory. I had 8 kids in the Dallas High School. Representative Fagan went there. I cannot tell you in my 30 years in that community of one instance where a Native American student felt diminished, picked on. It's an honor thing in the Dalles, and I'm offended that people on the State Board of Education, and I said this last year in the hearing, don't come into my community and tell us what to do when it's working fine. We get along great with the Warm Springs Tribe and the Yakima Tribe, and there are no problems. So don't quote reports and tell me that there are.
Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, I appreciate what you have to say, but you know, I can tell you stories of a busload of kids that came from Portland, Native American students that came from Portland, that came down here to testify, and they got here and they saw the vitriol and the hatred that was in the room at the Board of Education. They got back on the bus and went home. So there may be members of your community that feel that these images are honorable, but I can tell you, because I've talked to many Native American students throughout the state before I took this on, I did a thorough 8-month year of kind of research myself and talking to students and asking them. And only one student that I talked to, the nearly 100 over that period of time, said they don't care. The other students don't like the images. One of the students said, you know what, if you want to change something, make Native American culture and history a requirement for graduation. So I don't want to, you know, I respect your position. I don't want to argue about, you know, if your community has people that are offended, not offended. But, you know, none of us know that until we talk to people. I've talked to people, many of the tribes, some of the tribes have said and gone on record that they don't want this. These images to be used. And if you were to divide the tribes down the middle and you had Native Americans on this side, Native Americans on this side, that these were for it, these were against it, you had white people, whatever, on both sides, and you're trying to decide what's the right thing to do, what's the just thing to do, you have to look at the report and the research, because the research and the reports are undeniable. They're overwhelming. If they're not, I would love to see someone offer something that counters this research, something that says that these images in some way, shape, or form enhance Native American students' pride or anything.
Come to the Dalles.
That doesn't.
I'm countering it. Come to the Dalles.
Which has changed, Representative Chair. Well, they're changing their mascot.
Because the governor veto the bill, then whatever happened last year, they were forced down the road to eventually change the name. The legislature, the state board, nobody has jumped up and said, "Oh, we'll pay the $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 in expenses that my district's going to have to go through to be the Riverhawks or whatever they end up choosing." I just have heartburn all the way around, but I hide it well, and I appreciate it.
I think we need to move. I really don't want to cut you off because I know you were short last time, but we still have another person signed up to testify, and Representative Gorsuch has a question, and we have to vote.
Okay.
And we have to be out of here in 17 minutes.
I just want to say, with all due respect to John, who I love dearly, you cannot expect minority kids to start running around screaming about how they don't like being discriminated against. No more than what somebody said to the African-American kids, be an example. Tell those teachers, it's not going to work when they are the minority. They cannot go up against the constituted authority, which is Caucasian, and start causing a lot of trouble without huge amounts of grief. Secondly, this is my life. I teach this all the time. So please do not say how offended you are by research, because it offends me that people don't pay attention to the research.
All right. Any further comments? Representative
Stomberg.
Thank you.
And no, not a comment, a question. Sam, thanks for being here. And I do
Thank
have
you.
A question for you, and I want to make sure you understand it's a question, not an argumentative point.
Yes.
Because you and I share a couple of things in common. One of them is a lifelong religious and ethnic experience that colors how we see the world around us. Another is that I spent 4 years as the chair of the Human Rights Commission and Relations Commission here in Salem. So I'm sensitive and sympathetic to some of the points you're making. You said something earlier that really got my attention. I represent the Central Coast, and I represent a charter school in Seletz, Oregon, that calls themselves the Warriors. And I'm looking online, and I'm seeing a number of Jewish charter schools whose athletic teams call themselves the Maccabees. Help me understand whether you find both of those examples offensive or whether you think one of them helps better portray ethnic and cultural traditions.
Well, Chair Gelser, Representative Gornberg, if you're asking me personally, I don't think human beings should be used as mascots, period. If you look out here, the Coalition of Community Colors has a display of the Latino community, the Black community, Asian community. They're represented, the pictures out here are of human beings. They're not of mascots. So I don't think that people should be used as mascots personally. And Brandeis University, which is a predominantly Jewish college, is called the Owls. So if you're asking me, I don't think any, there's just too many mascots out there that can be used that don't include people and don't have this impact on students. And I'd like one last thing, Chair Gelser.
Very briefly.
Briefly. I'm not trying to tell you what to do in your community, and I don't think the Board of Education is. We're asking that each of you value the students in this state, whether you agree with them or not, and make sure that they have the right to be protected and go to school without being discriminated. I'm not telling you.
Thank you.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You very much. Thank All you. Right. Next we have Craig Lockridge, please. What? Yes, welcome.
Thank you
for being patient.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, member of the committee. My name is Craig Lockridge. I am a member of the board of directors of the Mullen River School District. And just really quickly, I don't want to waste any of your time. I just want to say that I completely agree with the testimony of the two people who were up here together a little while ago, Mr. Martin and I think it was Meeks. I don't recall.
Mason.
In any event, I just wanted to say the reality is one of our concerns as a school district is simply this, and that is that if you're concerned that this particular bill undoes the current mascot ban would allow some kind of change that you necessarily disagree with, our reading of it is quite the opposite. In fact, we're concerned that when the whole process is all over, that it's just going to kind of land in the same place that it is right now anyway, because in reality, we trust the tribes. And we actually do have faith in the governor and the people in his office who created this compromise. But the reality is the language of the amendment basically leaves complete discretion up to the State Board of Education. It doesn't say there has to be a single change. It simply says there has to be consultation with the nine federally recognized tribes of the state. And, you know, we believe that's really important. And for that reason, we would ask that you pass this bill and recommend it. Send it out to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Are there questions, Mr. Lockridge? I'm sorry I mispronounced your name when you came up before.
Lockridge. That's it. Lockridge, yes.
Lockridge, got it now. Any questions for Mr. Lockridge? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I believe Carrie Waters and Jill Erickson had to leave. Is that correct? So I've called everybody that signed up on the list. Yes? Great. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1509A and open up a work session on Senate Bill 1509A. Representative Spear.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate Bill 1509A to the floor be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Springer moves Senate Bill 1509A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who would like to start the discussion? Representative Fagan.
I was wondering, Madam Chair, if we might stand at ease for a moment. Just in literally a moment.
Yes, we can. So we are at ease for a moment.
Okay.
Please stand by. Okay, so when we were last in House Ed Committee, Representative Springer had moved. So we are in a work session. We were at ease. Representative Fagan started the discussion. We went at ease. We're back. Who would like to talk next? Representative Reardon.
This has been probably one of two most difficult votes that I've had to make in my short career here. And I hope I didn't mislead anybody earlier on what I stated. It's really hard because I have a lot of faith in the tribes and the people that have been speaking here today, and I want to advance the cause of education for Native Americans. But I want to do that for all. And so my question is that I still can't come to grips with is how do we have any kind of agreement that doesn't take into account necessarily all the kids. And if there are Native Americans or any other kids that are out there and they are feeling damaged by a mascot, I don't know how any governmental agreement can deal with that and overcome that. So I'm not sure I'm saying this as clearly as I would like to right now, but I will be a no on the bill.
Thank you very much. Representative Parrish.
Thanks. I know we'll be brief here. You know, I don't have a district that's affected by this bill. And, you know, but one of the most interesting things, I think, since I've come to the legislature that has been a very eye-opening experience and had the opportunity to go down to the coast where all of our First Nations
came and had that experience of just looking at how we have relationships with the tribal governments in our state. And I really believe that if we're going to, you know, look at a bill like this or any bill where we have that opportunity to work with folks who are in tribal government, that we have to go all the way with that. And that may be whether we agree philosophically with the language in this or not. You have tribal governments who've asked for us to have the opportunity to make these decisions at a local level. We have locally elected school boards. And so while this isn't necessarily my favorite bill, I really believe that if we're going to have good relations with tribal governments, we have to honor those relationships and allow them to engage with the rest of our government, whether it's at the state level or the school board level, and honor the agreements that they create, the compacts, if you will, with state to local or and tribal governments. That's been probably the most interesting learning experience for me, because it wasn't anything that I'd had experience with before I came to the legislature, and I really appreciate the work that our tribal governments do to represent their people, to be open to what's going on in our communities, and to want to engage. And I think for us to impede that process, even though they are not necessarily 100% unified, I think is a mistake. And so I am going to support the bill and hope that we continue to have further dialogue. I think it's important.
Thank you very much. Representative Gumberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been a long time since I was in high school, but I graduated from a school that was called the Warriors as well, and I remember inappropriate things that happened way back then. I've seen the data. I'm sensitive to the issues that we're talking about, and I've struggled with this bill, as I think a number of you have. When it came to us last time, it was significant to me that the leadership of my two tribes were strongly in support of it. I certainly understand that they don't speak for 100% of their constituency, and any more than this legislature speaks for 100% of our constituencies. But in respect for those two tribes, I supported the bill previously. Now we've got a compromise that I feel much more comfortable with, and I think the point needs to be made that a ban doesn't educate anybody about anything. It just simply says stop. What we've got now is an opportunity for something more constructive, an opportunity for ethnic sensitivity, for education about the role of our traditional tribes here on the coast, and I think that the compromise that we're looking for is more constructive, is more proactive, and therefore I'm more supportive of the legislation that we've got before us now. I'll be voting yes.
Thank you. Any further comments? No further comments?
Nope.
All right. Well, I would... I just want to thank the members of the committee for considering this bill and a lot of others. I think one of the challenges that we have in House Ed is we hear bills that are really important to people. We all come to the legislature, we all come to this committee with a variety of perspectives and concerns, and we can disagree pretty passionately here. We do pretty often. But the thing that I appreciate about each member of this committee is the very deep compassion and commitment to kids and all kids succeeding. And no matter what it is that we're wrestling with here, I never doubt that any one of you are here for any reason except for to build stronger schools for all the kids in the state. And I'm just really grateful that we have a committee that is so passionate and devoted, and that we can have these kinds of conversations and walk out of the room and know we're all kind of batting for the same team regardless of how we end up voting. So it's just really an honor to work with all of you. And with that, Debbie, could you please call the roll?
Representative Fagan.
Yes.
Representative Gumberg.
Aye.
Representative Gorsuch.
No.
Representative Huffman.
Yes.
Representative Perry.
Yes.
Representative Wisnan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Reardon?
No.
Vice Chair Springer?
Yes.
Chair Gelser?
Yes. The motion passes. And Representative Springer, would you carry the bill, please?
Thank you.
Yes, I would. All right. So with that, I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 1509. And thank you all for sticking around. Watch your agendas to see what's up for Wednesday and Friday. And if you have suggestions for next week, I know Representative Reardon sent me one, let me know. And with that, we are adjourned.
That was a tough issue. Looking forward to having that. That was a tough issue. Looking forward to having that.